Okay. Welcome to the 98th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into radiology. In today's podcast, I guess I'll just go ahead and foreshadow this with a warning. Whatever views I express in this podcast does not reflect the views of any residency program I am involved with or will be involved with. But today's podcast will basically be a step three, or we can see like medicine in training exam or medicine board exam review. And today's topic is going to be about the management of DKA or HHNS. Those are both diabetic emergencies. So let's jump right into it, right? So we know that diabetes, right, can have multiple complications, and probably one of the most serious ones, right, are like DKA and HHS. DKA, classically, the blood glucose is less than 800, but I will encourage you to not hang your hat on that number, especially for purposes of test taking, because the thing is, on tests, you may see a blood glucose that is higher than 800, but they have like ketosis, right? And that still will be a diagnosis of DKA. So I would go based on the presence of ketosis or acidemia to help you delineate between DKA versus HHS. But classically, patients with HHS, they have much higher blood glucose levels versus patients with DKA that tend to be on the lower side of things, usually less than 800, right? So these things can arise for many different reasons. It can arise in the setting of like a new diagnosis of diabetes. It can arise in the setting of a patient that's not compliant with their home medications, right? Or they run out of their meds. Those are classic ways these things happen, like clinically in the hospital. So if a patient comes in with DKA or HHS, right? Obviously you're going to obtain labs, right? And classically the patient will have like polyuria, polydipsia. They'll basically feel pretty crummy, right? And you get labs. And if you're dealing with DKA, again, the glucose will be pretty high, right? And then in addition to that, they'll have other electrolyte abnormalities, right? So their bicarb will be low, showing that they're acidotic. They'll have a pretty significant ketosis, right? So you can detect the ketones in their blood, especially like beta hydroxybutyrate, and you'll detect the ketones in their urine as well. And those patients, especially both DKAers and patients with HHNS, they tend to have hyponatremia, right? But it's a pseudo hyponatremia, right? So it's like a hyper or smaller hyponatremia, right? And you probably want to know how to do the correction for things like this. And again, forgive my ums and ahs. I'm literally giving this off the cuff. But basically, say for example, you have a patient with a blood glucose of like 1,000, right? Or let's use 900 as a cutoff value. Basically, the way I figure out, and let's say their blood glucose in the hospital is 120, what I typically do is I subtract the 100 from their blood glucose. So in this case, it will be 800. And then I ask myself, how many hundreds is that, right? So that is 8 100s, right? So it's like 800 divided by 100 is 8. And then I take that 8 and multiply by 1.6. So 1.6 times 8, I believe, is 12.8. So we can round that up to 13. So this patient's true blood glucose, if it's 120 in the hospital, it's actually 133. Okay, and obviously the way you treat that kind of hyper or smaller hyponatremia is to treat the underlying condition, in this case DKA or HHNS. And then patients with DKA, right, they can also have like potassium problems, right? So they may be hyperkalemic on labs, but their total body potassium is actually depleted, right? And the reasoning behind that is because they are peeing a ton, right? So they are peeing out a lot of potassium. And HHS, basically it's pretty much the same presentation as DKA. Only thing is patients with HHS tend to be a lot more volume depleted. They can be like up to 10 liters volume down. And then in addition to that, they do not have the acidemia on labs. They do not have the ketosis. So that's the classic, those are the classic things you want to think about with DKA versus HHS. But the treatment is largely the same for both. There are some like minute differences, but the treatment is largely the same. So basically the first thing you do is fluids, right? You need to start those patients on fluids. And the fluid that you typically start with is normal saline. Okay, you start with normal saline. And classically, at least as per the guidelines, you can start with like a liter an hour of normal saline. You can do that for like a few hours, right? So maybe like 2 hours, 3 hours, right? So you give them probably up to like 3 liters or thereabouts, depending on how volume down they are. And then after that, you can then begin to think about, instead of doing normal sailing, you can then switch to half normal sailing. And I'll talk about certain decisions you can make under those circumstances. And at the end, I'll try to sort of like summarize the salient points from this podcast. But basically, you worry about their fluids, and then other things you worry about, right? You worry about their insulin. Right? And their insulin, right? Typically, you give them a bolus first. And classically, what I do when I'm in the hospital, or what the guidelines sort of suggest, is like 0.1 units per kilogram, right? So say, for example, you have a 100 kilogram patient, right? If you're given 0.1 units per kilogram, you can give a bolus of 10 units, right? Because 0.1 times 100 is 10. So you give that bolus, and the bolus is regular insulin, right? So like insulin regular. And then after that, you start them on an insulin drip, right? So like an insulin infusion, basically. And again, the infused insulin is also regular insulin. And again, you start at a rate of 0.1 units per kilogram per hour, right? So say, for example, it's a patient that has, that's in a, that again, has a weight of 100 kilograms, 0.1 units per kilogram per hour. That's like 10 units per hour. That's what you're supposed to do per the guidelines, right? But classically in the hospital, for myself, so that's just, again, these are all my opinions, does not reflect the opinions of anyone. But classically, I tend to undershoot a little. I'm err on the side of start low and go high, then start really high and then make the person hypoglycemic, right? So start low. So I mean, start at like a small number, like 5 units per hour, stuff like that, and then just see if the patient's blood glucose is not dropping by like 70 milligrams per deciliter every hour, then you can titrate upwards. But if you start them at a low amount and you're clearing like 50-70 milligrams per deciliter, that is good enough glucose fix under those circumstances. So again, insulin, you start with a bolus of regular insulin, 0.1 units per kilogram. And then after that, like minutes later, you start them on an insulin infusion at 0.1 units per kilogram per hour, okay? And then you also have to think about the potassium though, right? So if a patient with NDK or HHS has a potassium less than 3.3, you should not start insulin under those circumstances. You need to wait until their potassium goes above 3.3 before you can start giving insulin. And when the potassium is between 3.3 and 5.3, you actually are advised to add potassium to whatever fluid they're getting, right? So if, for example, they're getting normal saline, for every liter, it is recommended that you add like 20 milliequivalents of potassium to every liter of fluid that they're getting if their potassium is between 3.3 and 5.3. If their potassium is above 5.3, you do not necessarily need to add potassium to their fluids. So you start your insulin regimen, you're paying attention to the potassium, you're paying attention to their fluids. There are certain things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So say, for example, you've done that initial bolus of fluids. Let's say you've given them like 3 1-liter normal saline boluses. The next decision you make, usually the next decision you try to make is to switch them to half normal saline, right? So like 0.45% normal saline. But you have to sort of do a certain, at least this is how I think about it. You make a certain calculation before you go down that route, right? And the calculation you make is basically calculate their corrected sodium. If you calculate their corrected sodium using the formula I espoused on at the beginning, and they are normal or hypernatremic, then you can go ahead and immediately switch them to half normal saline, to 0.45% normal saline. But if they are hyponatremic, even with the corrected sodium, so let's say you calculate their corrected sodium and it's like 131, I would elect, and the guidelines indicate that you should consider continuing those people on normal saline instead. But the thing is, the rate you continue at is typically about 250 cc's per hour. Again, if the patient is more volume down, you can start at a higher rate, but you can do like 250 cc's per hour, and that should tidy the patient over. That's like getting a liter over a 4-hour period. But again, know that this is after that initial bolus. You need to give that initial bolus of like 2 liters or thereabouts to sort of like tidy them over. Okay. Now, so you give, you start the insulin, you start the potassium, you start the insulin infusion. Another thing you can also think about is the acidotic state, right? So say, for example, if a person has a pH of like 6.9, right? What some people think about is, you know what, why can, should I add bicarb? The thing is, it's very controversial. Usually, if you treat the DK or the HHNS, the acidemia typically resolves. So you very rarely need to give a DKA person bicarb. But if you do, I'll say in general, people do it only when they have like pHs of 6.9 and it's not correcting after a few hours of starting like an insulin infusion. And some of you may ask, Divine, why would the people that are diabetic in DK or HHS require the volume, right? Why are you giving them all this fluid? The reason you're giving them the fluid is that by giving the fluid, right, you are beginning to volume. One, I mean, they've been peeing a ton, right, because they've been polyuric, right? So by giving the fluid, you correct their volume deficits. And the thing is, as you correct the volume deficits, that actually sort of like makes them hemodynamically stable, right? And remember, right, when you're like volume down, your body interprets that as stress. And when your body interprets that as stress, it begins to release counter-regulatory hormones like cortisol. So if you're beginning to expand their volume, your body is like, oh, my stress is decreasing. So if your body is like, oh, my stress is decreasing, your body will stop releasing those counter-regulatory hormones like cortisol. And if it's not releasing cortisol anymore, guess what happens? Remember, cortisol makes you hyperglycemic, right? You're basically removing a hormone from play that makes you hyperglycemic in the first place. And there are many other things the volume expansion does, but that is beyond the scope of our discussion today. So you keep managing the patient. And again, your target is, right, to try to get their blood glucose down by like 50 to 70 milligrams per deciliter every hour. Okay. If the patient's blood glucose is going down like by huge amounts, like 200 mg per deciliter per hour, then you want to be careful. You sort of want to turn down that insulin infusion. So let's say it's like a rate of 5 units per hour. You probably want to go ahead and drop it down to like 2 units per hour, right? And then titrate as needed, right? You don't want to plump the person's glucose down too much. Remember, from one of my earlier podcasts, I mentioned that you don't want to correct any electrolyte anomaly too fast, right? So you don't get into trouble. So certain key points you sort of want to put at the back of your mind is, while you're doing all these things, you also have to actually like monitor the patient, right? So classically, if a patient is in DKA or in HHNS, the guidelines actually recommend that you do like 1 hour glucose checks. So every hour you check their blood glucose, okay? Because remember, that blood glucose is what guides a lot of the decisions that you can make in the setting of DKA or HHNS. And then you should also check a BNP fairly frequently, right? So again, most people recommend checking every 2 to 4 hours. Although again, all of this, I'm saying this mainly for the purposes of exams. I mean, this will probably help in your clinical world, but again, these podcasts are not meant for clinical decision making. Even if they may help you with clinical decision making, that is not the goal. That is not the purpose. I'm not making any of those promises. But I will just go ahead and posit that it depends on your hospital's philosophy. There are hospitals I've seen where BMPs are checked every 8 hours, some every 4 hours, some every 2 hours, okay? But the guidelines, the things you need to know for exam, say, try to check it every 2 to 4 hours. Now, so let's go to an important, I guess, point in this entire process, right? So if we get to, let's look at the person that has DKA. If a person has DKA, right, and their blood glucose dips below 200, if it gets to 200, and their gap closes, so basically, if their anion gap sort of goes below 12, right, then they're basically beginning to come out of the woods. But the thing is, when their blood glucose dips below 200, it also marks an important transition point in your therapy, right? When the person's blood glucose drops below 200, the next step in management on an exam, this is a pretty common exam question, is to go ahead and add dextrose to their regimens, right? So based solely on the glucose 200 or less for a DKA person, go ahead and add a dextrose to their regimen, right? Because remember, they are having an insulin infusion. You don't want them to become hypoglycemic. In the case of a person that has HHNS, If their blood glucose is between 250 to 300, that is also when you want to go ahead and add dextrose to their, basically to the fluids they're getting, to the 0.45% saline that they're getting. Now, at that, in the case of a person that has DKA, right, when their gap closes, right, so the gap is defined as closed if it drops below 12, right, so you calculate the anion gap. If it drops below 12, that tells you their gap is closed. If their gap is closed, at that time, you can then go ahead and start those patients on subcutaneous insulin, right? So like the basal bolus insulin. And I'll talk about how you approach that particular problem, right? So you can go ahead and start their basal bolus insulin. If you're diabetic and you're on insulin outside at home, right? You usually can start them on their home regimen, and that should do. But if you're insulin naive, I'll talk about what you do under those circumstances. So basically, you do the bolus, basal bolus regimen. But the thing is, when you're starting that basal bolus regimen, you do not immediately turn off the insulin infusion. Okay, because the thing is, if you turn off the insulin infusion immediately, right, remember it's an infusion, you're giving this IV, the bioavailability is like 100%. If you turn off the insulin infusion, they can actually get like a rebound hyperglycemia, and you can actually throw them right back into DKA. So you do not want to do that. Under those circumstances, right, so when you hit that magic, like, oh, the gap is closed, it's 12 or less, the anion gap is 12 or less, start the subcutaneous insulin. Right, but when you start that subcutaneous insulin, remember that you need to keep that going for 2 hours before you then go ahead and turn off the insulin infusion. Okay, so there should basically be like a 2 hour overlap between when you start the insulin the subcutaneous insulin and when you turn off the insulin infusion, right? And I said that, oh, the trigger for knowing that, okay, let me go ahead and start sub-Q insulin in a DKA person is if the gap closes. The trigger for you to go ahead and start sub-Q insulin in a HHNS person is if their glucose is below 250, okay, and the patient is demanding food. Basically, if the patient is ready to eat and their glucose is 250 or less, you can go ahead and start subcutaneous insulin. Now, and remember, right, your subcutaneous insulin is like the long-acting that you give like usually once a day, and then the rapid-acting that you give with meals. Okay, so I said that when you start that subcutaneous insulin, you basically start their home regimen, right? So you start them on their long acting, start them on their rapid acting with meals. But let's assume it's a patient that's insulin naive, or you're like, Divine, I don't really know what to do here. One thing you can actually consider is to start them at, so basically what you can do is you can calculate their total daily requirement of insulin. Right. So one way you can do that is you can pick a conservative number. The guidelines say that you can consider like 0.5 units per kilogram. Right. So again, I love to give people like actual numbers. So let's assume you have a patient that is 120 kilograms. 0.5 units times 120 kilograms is 60 units. Right. So basically those patients, their total daily insulin requirement is 60 units. The next thing you do is to divide that number in two. So 30 units in one portion, 30 units in the other portion. The first number, 30 units, is what they should get as their long acting, right? So long acting, you get 30 units, maybe like lunch in 30 units at night. And then the other 30 units, you basically divide that into the number of meals they get in a day. Most people eat three times a day, right? So you can say, you know what, I'll give you 10 units of insulin with each meal. That is what you can do for an insulin naive person or a person where you're not very sure of their home insulin regimen. But again, the thing is, you want to be careful, right? You want to be careful. That is what the guidelines indicate. But in the real world, personally, if I'm studying a patient, like an insulin naive patient, again, I always try to go low first. I don't, but the 0.5 units per kilogram is usually a pretty safe number to go with. But if, let's say, you make the calculation is an astronomical number like 200 units or like something crazy, I mean, I will be very suspect of starting a person on like 100 units of long acting insulin at night. I would err on the side of starting small, right? Start at a small, reasonable number, right, that you feel comfortable with, and then sort of go from there, okay? But that 0.5 units per kilogram is a good, safe number you can sort of keep at the back of your mind. If you're scared and you get like super high numbers from that calculation, maybe go ahead and half that number to like 0.25 units, okay? But again, I'll leave that up to your own clinical decision making or your own hospital's policy. Again, this podcast is meant purely to, mainly to prepare people for tests. Okay. So that is basically what you, that's basically what you do. That's essentially how you manage DKA or HHNS, right? And remember, right, under those circumstances, you want to tell the patient, you know, stick with your insulin regimen, check your blood glucose regularly. Because again, medication non-compliance is probably one of the more, I'm not saying the most common cause, but it's one of the more common causes of people being thrown into DKA or HHNS. But what are some other considerations you need to keep at the back of your mind if you are treating a patient with DKA, HHNS? You actually want to make sure that you look for something that may be triggering their underlying condition, right? So they may have an infection that may be triggering their DKA or HHS. They may have an MI, right? So you want to check like troponins. You want to check a white count, right? You want to check a CBC with differential, right? You just want to make sure you evaluate them for something bad that may be happening, that may be causing, that may be triggering. Because again, remember, if you're stressed, if you're sick, or if you have an MI, your body interprets that as metabolic stress. So your stress hormones get released like cortisol. And if cortisol gets released, it will make you hyperglycemic and it can throw you into DKA. Okay, so you need to look for those underlying causes. And then another high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is if you correct the glucose too quickly, right? So you probably remember this mantra that relates to sodium, right, from step one, right? So like from low to high, the pons will die. From high to low, the brain will blow, right? So if you correct hypernatremia too quickly, right, those patients can have cerebral edema and hernia and die, right? You don't want that. Same thing, right? In fact, I sort of think of it with like hypernatremia, hyperglycemia. If you correct the person's glucose a little too fast, you can actually also get into trouble with cerebral edema, right? And classically, the way that I'll present on an exam is if a patient becomes like more somnolent, they become like less arousable, they become disoriented, and they're getting an insulin infusion for the treatment of DKA or HHNS, you want to begin to think about cerebral edema, right? And there are certain things you could have done in the first instance to sort of like decrease the risk of that happening, like adding dextrose when a DKA person's blood glucose dips below 200, or adding dextrose when a HHNS person's blood glucose is in that 250, basically dips below that 250 to 300 range. Okay, so those are things to think about. And again, if the person like becomes comatose, right, you could consider mannitol. Mannitol is probably the right answer on an exam, or like 3% hypertonic ceiling. Okay, so I'm just trying to think if there is any other high yield major thing I want to talk about. Personally, I think that's all I want to say with regards to DKA, HHNS. Again, don't forget, just key things, just as a quick high-yield key summary. Don't forget, right? They come in, get your BMP, get your CBC. If they have ketosis, if they have ketones or an acidemia, they have DKA. If they don't have ketones or acidemia, they have HHNS, right? Look at their potassium. If it's less than 3.3, you cannot start insulin. If it's between 3.3 and 5.3, go ahead and include insulin with the fluids they're getting. In terms of fluids, you can give initial boluses of like a liter an hour, okay? You can give it up to like 2-3 liters or thereabouts. And then after that, you need to start them on like maintenance fluids, right? And the way you make that determination is if you calculate their corrected sodium, are they hypernatremic or is their sodium normal? If they're hypernatremic and their sodium is normal, you go ahead and you can put them on a 0.45% saline, so half normal saline. If they're hyponatremic after you calculate the corrected sodium, then you start them on, you continue them on normal saline. And you can do that at a rate of like 250 cc's per hour, or you can go a little higher if they're like really, really volume down, right? And then don't forget key transition things, right? You want to make sure that if a person has DKA and their blood glucose dips below 200, add dextrose to their fluids. If it's a HHNS person, if it dips below like the 250 to 300 range, just remember 250. If it dips below 250 and you're in HHNS, go ahead and add dextrose to their fluids. And again, remember, if they have a potassium between 3.3 and 5.3, it's recommended that you add like 20 milli equivalents of potassium to every liter of fluid that they're getting. And other key things to keep in mind, right? So if a person is in DKA and their gap closes, or a person is in HHNS and their glucose dips below 250 and the patient is demanding to eat. So again, these are the things that tell you that you can start sub-Q insulin. For a DKA person, did the gap close, right? So has the gap closed? Is their glucose less than 200? For a HHNS person, is their glucose below 250 and are they demanding food? Okay, if you get to that point, then go ahead and start subcutaneous insulin, but start that subcutaneous insulin while their insulin infusion is still running. Okay, when they've gotten the sub-Q insulin for like a 2-hour period, then you can turn off the insulin infusion. And I say that if a person is insulin naive, or you don't know what their insulin regimen at home looks like or should look like, let's say it's like a non-compliant patient, you can consider starting them at like insulin at like 0.5 units per kilogram, right? Multiply that by their body weight, right? And then basically divvy that into two. The first half of that is their basal insulin, what they get like at night or in the morning or whatever, they are long acting. And then the other number, you get the other half, divide it into three and give that amount to them with each of their three meals for the day. Okay, so those are key things you want to keep in mind. Don't crash the glucose too quickly, right? So usually you want to lower the glucose by like 50 to 70 milligrams per deciliter per hour. If it's not going down by that much, you may want to up your insulin infusion rate. If it's going down too quickly, you want to decrease your insulin infusion rate. So those are high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, this topic is very commonly tested. Don't forget the cerebral edema that can happen if you correct a little too quickly. So with that, I'm going to close. But I just want to throw out there, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS Step 3 exams, the medicine in training exam, the medicine board exam, the preclinical med school exams, right? So like your first and second year exams, and then the third year clerkship shelf exams. And then if you have an acquaintance that needs tutoring for like biochemistry, organic chemistry, general chemistry, physics, physiology, I do histology even. I do offer tutoring for all those. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer consulting for those. So I do like interview prep. I help with personal statements, with preparing applications and whatnot, because I have a lot of familiarity with that process. And I've been on the admissions committee of like a top 2 med school in the country for like a year. And pretty much everyone I advised with this last cycle matched. So it's just one of those things, I guess. Take that for what you will. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day, and God bless you. I'll see you next time.